Hi, everyone, and welcome to The Great Integral Awakening. My name is Claire Zammit, and in addition to being one of the presenters in the series, I'm also on the board of Integral Enlightenment, the organization that's producing this event. It's great to have you with us for today's special event featuring Terry Patton and Craig Hamilton. So before we begin, I want to take a moment to thank you all for your emails in support of our decision to continue the Great Integral Awakening series as a monthly teleseminar. We're delighted that so many of you share our enthusiasm for continuing this work. I also want to thank you for your active participation in this dialogue so far, both on our live teleseminars and on our Facebook forum. I also want to let you know that we still have some places left in the second session of our Integral Enlightenment telecourse, starting October 17th. Integral Enlightenment founder Craig Hamilton will be teaching a 9-week telecourse called Integral Enlightenment, Awakening to an Evolutionary Relationship to Life. It's going to unpack in concrete terms what it means to live everything we've been exploring in the series, how to sustain and ground in an evolutionary and integral relationship to life. We have an in-depth online brochure at integralenlightenment.com/telecourse. We just announced this new session on Wednesday, and the course is already more than half full, so we're expecting it to sell out soon. So if you're interested in that opportunity, I'd encourage you to register right away. This will be our last course for 2009, and again, that's integralenlightenment.com/telecourse. We have a special event today with Craig and Terry co-hosting a recap of where we've been and look at where we're going. So I'd like to hand it over to both Craig and Terry.
Well, thank you, Claire, and hello, everyone, and welcome back. A little while ago, we thought this was going to be the last show in our series, but now it turns out it's just going to be a bridge because we are going to be continuing this on a monthly basis. But we really thought that given the kind of depth of the journey we've all been on together over the summer and, you know, just the sort of very tight focus we've been following and the real depth we've been pushing into, that it made sense to do a kind of wrap-up call, even though it's not really a wrap-up, but to sort of to bring some closure to this particular chapter in the conversation we've all been having, and then also as kind of a bridge, really, to what's going to be the next chapter in the Great Integral Awakening, which we'll talk about. So that's really the intent behind today, and we made it a 2-hour teleseminar because, you know, as we've been going through this, there's always been the sense that wouldn't it be great if more people could participate more, you know, if we had time, and we tried to keep them to an hour and a half. We didn't always succeed, but we thought today just to go ahead and open it up to 2 hours and have a lot more time, really, for your input in whatever ways. Terry and I will dialogue about things for about an hour, and then we'll have another hour where we can all talk together and hear, you know, from you, not just your questions, but certainly room for your questions, but also just to hear your thoughts on different aspects of what's been explored, areas that you'd like to hear more about, just all of it, and also just how the series has impacted you. I think we'd also like to hear some of that. So we'll go into all that. But for now, really, I think Terry and I just wanted to dive in a bit together and talk about sort of some of the major themes and things that have happened over the last several months. I'm delighted to be here with Terry, who's become a good friend of mine, really, over the past year since we met at the Integral Theory and Action Conference last summer, or rather summer before last now. And Terry and I are now, in fact, working together to expand the reach and the impact of Bay Area Integral here in the San Francisco Bay Area. So if you are in this area and you want to connect with us around local events, please do go to bayareaintegral.com, and you can see we even have an event tomorrow with Alan Combs. So a lot happening there. For those of you who don't know Terry, he has really emerged as a leading voice in the fields of integral spirituality and integral leadership. He worked with Ken Wilber and a core team at Integral Institute to develop Integral Life Practice, which has really I think, come forward as a major contribution to our thinking about spirituality and about transformation in general. It distills ancient and modern practices into an intelligent, contemporary transformational lifestyle. And Terry also has a history in another entire realm, really, as a successful entrepreneur, having founded the catalog company Tools for Exploration, which was really defining the field of consciousness technologies for a long time. He's also a social entrepreneur and conservationist involved in restorative redwood forestry. And he also teaches in the Integral Executive Education Program at the University of Notre Dame. He's an integral coach, a consultant, a teacher, the author of 4 books, and he's worked for 30 years to integrate ancient and modern practices to raise consciousness. He lives in Marin County, California, and he is the author with Ken Wilber of Integral Life Practice, a 21st century blueprint for physical health, emotional balance, mental clarity, and spiritual awakening. And you can learn more about Terry at his website, integralheart.com. That's Integral Heart. And one of the things that I really love about Terry, now that I've gotten to know him, is just that he holds this kind of rare combination of authentic depth and also real breadth of understanding. He's both a deep spiritual practitioner who really speaks from decades of his own intensive spiritual practice, and he's also an extremely bright and broadly educated guy who can speak intelligently about pretty much everything, from what I can tell. So I'm really looking forward to having Terry here in this unusual role, sort of co-hosting with me today. So please join me in welcoming Terry to our forum. Hey, Terry.
Hey, thank you, Craig. It's really a pleasure to rejoin you at the end of this remarkable series of conversations and to kind of look back and look forward with all of this under our belt. I'm particularly happy to do this with you. Let me tell you a bit about Craig if you haven't joined us before. Craig is a contemporary mystic and a pioneer in the emerging field of integral and evolutionary spirituality. And in his work at Integral Enlightenment, Craig integrates decades of intensive spiritual practice with insights gleaned during his 8 years as senior editor of the award-winning What is Enlightenment magazine. Through his writings and teachings, he's helping to articulate an authentic evolutionary mysticism and integral enlightenment, which illuminates the vital relationship between individual transformation and collective evolution. Craig's a founding member of Ken Wilber's Integral Institute and a participant in the Synthesis Dialogues, a 35-person interdisciplinary think tank presided over by His Holiness the Dalai Lama. Craig is living and teaching in Berkeley, California, where he offers instruction and guidance in meditation and other aspects of evolutionary spiritual practice. And for anyone who's interested, he'll also soon be offering the teleseminar that Claire just mentioned, a series on integral enlightenment. More than all that, as you can probably tell from the way he's been hosting these conversations, he's just a supple, relaxed, very human, and grounded person who sincerely presses himself beyond ego into service of the greater emergent consciousness that's coming into our world right now. And in doing that, he's able to be, I think, both a leader and humble, you know, both receptive and very creative and generative. And I've found it really rich and fun to dialogue with him for many hours and to watch him blossom more and more, even in the really, you know, just 15 or 16 months that we've been friends. So I'm really happy to kind of shine a light on you, Craig. You know, you've been interviewing us all summer long, and, you know, I think it's about time that somebody interviewed you.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, I'd like to hear more about your vision behind this series. You know, why did you create it in the first place, anyway?
Well, first, thanks for your warm introduction, Terry. That's sweet. So that's a good place to start. So, you know, in a sense, this series really came about because, you know, in my work at Integral Enlightenment, I've really been looking at how really just trying to call it, to question the tacit assumption that I think sort of perhaps, you know, permeates a lot of our just general thinking about spirituality, which is that, you know, in a sense that all of the, that there's nothing new under the sun, you know, that in a sense that even though we might have new insights about, you know, psychology or how to integrate spirituality and psychology or different things like that, that fundamentally the mystical path really is timeless and changeless, and that in a sense everything that there was to learn about enlightenment, if you will, was learned by the ancients who discovered it in the first place, and you know, whether it's the Buddha or whoever we want to point to, but really that the great mystics of yore, you know, had in a sense all the insight that was needed and came to and gave birth to practices and approaches that were, you know, gonna serve humanity forever. And in a sense, I don't know that this is something a lot of us maybe would say we believe, but if we look at most of what's done in the name of what we might call contemporary mysticism or, you know, authentic transformative spirituality, most of the practice that's done is still, it's the same practice that was done 1,000 years ago. A lot of our same practice that was done 2,000 years ago. You know, we sit down to meditate. We're meditating the same way people have always meditated. And it wasn't so much that I thought, well, we need to update meditation per se, but it was just recognizing that humanity, that not only has the world changed a lot since the great traditions came into being, but that human beings are really, we're completely different than we were back then. And I guess completely is the wrong word, because obviously we're the same in many ways. You know, we're still these basic, you know, we have the same brains, we're the same kind of biological organism. But really, with the kind of bootstrapping of human culture and the gradual development of human consciousness into kind of greater levels of complexity, deeper levels of interiority of a kind of, and now more recently in the last whatever, maybe couple hundred years, this development of our kind of this individuated self, this strong self-sense coming forward, and a kind of self-awareness that we now have, that these are really new things. And so the question I kind of had was, well, how might we approach the path to enlightenment, the authentic mystical transformative path, if we weren't just to assume that the traditions knew everything we need to know, and we were to instead almost start fresh, not so much leaving behind the vast wisdom of traditions, because we would probably do that at our peril, you know, ignoring, you know, eons of learning, but more just looking and saying, well, okay, what path would we create for human beings now with all of our complexity, also with our relational complexity that we now have, because again, we are intimate with each other in a way that our forebears were not. They weren't intimate with themselves so much. They didn't have that kind of cultivated interior sense of self. They weren't so intimate with each other. Things, relationships and roles were much more formal. And we now have a kind of, you know, relational sensitivity and, you know, and that along with everything else I mentioned, there was just a sense of, well, what would the path look like for us if we were approaching it fresh from an enlightened perspective? In other words, not simply from a psychological perspective where we're just saying, well, how can we heal our wounds? And, you know, kind of within a, well, we can go more into what I mean by that, but not so much just from a sort of Western psychotherapeutic perspective of healing, because that we could say is a uniquely modern insight, the kind of that we're wounded and we need to heal, but more from a perspective of enlightenment, mysticism, transformation, what kind of path would we create? And therefore, how does the spiritual path need to evolve, both to meet us where we are and to meet this kind of crazy, fast-paced, chaotic world that we find ourselves in, that, again, you know, you look at what it's like to be, to just live in this world that we have compared to what it was like to live when, you know, you had a few oxen, maybe a cart, and you know, your sphere of activity was, you know, maybe a couple square miles, you know, maybe a few more than that. But, you know, that was your world, and you had a sphere of people that you were in touch with that was, you know, maybe you knew about 50 people or something compared to this explosion we're in now. Again, you know, how might we do it differently? So that was really the inquiry behind the series. I was pushing into this myself with Integral Enlightenment and kind of innovating and developing my own ideas. But I really thought I want to bring in all a lot of the folks I know who are also asking these questions and from an integral perspective and really trying to look and see, you know, what might we learn about this if we explored it together? What could we learn from each other? And what might just emerge in the conversation? So that was really the goal and the vision.
That's very rich. Yeah, I've contemplated this often myself, just thinking even almost in the sheer physics of the human nervous system of a simple villager in Tibet in, you know, 1750 who might be chosen to go to a monastery when he's 15. What are the stimulations that brain and nervous system would have received? You know, the wonders of the Tibetan plateau, I'm sure, are very, very rich. But when you compare that to one of us who's dealing with the incredible amount of information, perhaps more information flooding through us in a week than might have gone through that simpler person's mind and body in their whole lifetime. And the, as you said, the deeper levels of interiority and intersubjective intimacy and sophistication, something's got to change.
Mm.
I really appreciate that. Well, so what do you think? How did the series live up to your expectations? Do you feel like it has fulfilled on the vision?
Well, yeah, you know, surprisingly, I kind of do feel that way. And I say surprisingly because, you know, I mean, I put out a big, bold vision there at the beginning. I even had a few people say, oh, this is too dramatic, you know, this whole idea that it's all new. And, you know, I got a few of those emails kind of, there's nothing
great
to run to this
Integral time. Awakening.
Yeah, right? How grandiose of you, you know. So, but actually, you know, the truth is I found that, you know, I mean, we had 14 conversations so far, and I found all of them to be bearing insight, you know, to be real, you know, we pushed into a lot of different aspects of this, and, you know, we can talk about some of those in a few minutes, but my overall sense was that everybody had some interesting things to say about this particular question, about how things because really, I think the theme that emerged in the end was how does the spiritual path need to evolve to meet us where we are and to meet our world, but also how is it already evolving? Because there's obviously a lot that's cooking, you know, and a lot of the people I invited on were people who are innovating in various creative ways, you know, from yourself talking about integral life practice and all that deep work that you and your team have done to really bring forward this new kind of transformative path that's so integral in Michael Murphy and what he's done in that area and the conversations we had, to my conversation with Genpo Roshi, who's really, you know, very, in some ways, you know, a very deep traditionalist. Like he's deeply aligned with his tradition of Zen, but really playing out there at the edge, innovating, taking these ideas from voice dialogue and thinking about, well, how might we take that into the Dharma? How might we use that as a kind of interesting kind of meditative, contemplative tool for us to get some distance from the parts of ourself we're normally identified with and start to also be able to just simply step into and identify with parts of ourself that are truly cosmic or spiritual or, you know, transcendent. And you know, on and on to some of the conversations about how to deal with the shadow and become awake to what our shadow is, you know, et cetera. Obviously, there's such a richness. I'm starting to get into trying to summarize the entire series in 1 minute. But Yeah, so in the end, I did feel that we really were able to break some ground, to push forward. I think many of the conversations, both of us, both me and the person I was talking to, felt like we had some ahas along the way and new insights. And so I think so. What do you think? Because you actually, I really appreciate, have listened to the vast majority of the series. And so I'd love to get your kind of take on some of that as well.
Well, I think it was very rich. I really appreciated it because it was both in some sense large in that it sprawled through a lot of territory, but it was also contained. You know, this wasn't just a vast chaotic library of interesting conversations all over the map. It had a real through line and it had themes, just as you've articulated. And you know, I thought one thing that was interesting about it is that you were a very friendly interviewer to all of us, and you really kind of drew out our thinking. And the fullness of that defined a large territory. I guess what's occurring to me, though, is there is a something else yet to be done, in that I think there were probably some differences of view that probably didn't get a chance to be highlighted, and that remain as an interesting set of questions for me when I think about it. I think it fulfilled it fulfilled the vision in the sense of setting forth the ferment and the aliveness of the current emergent, and the fact that people are actively, creatively engaging in creating what hasn't manifested fully yet. So that was especially exciting. What I think is left to be done is both to explore the ways that some of us had different emphases and maybe even slight disagreements. I think there's room for us to support one another in creating something that we're all a part of, and still to have a kind of vigorous debate. And so I'm curious about that. And I'm also curious about the living detail, almost the in the trenches how-to of living this. I think the experiment is framing itself up, and yet there's a deeper dive that I feel these conversations set the stage, I guess, for something more. And I think your sense is to go there with the teleseminar, maybe.
You mean with my telecourse? Yeah,
yes.
Definitely. Well, yeah, two things. I mean, certainly in terms of that real deep unpacking of what does it mean to live this, that is the intention behind creating the Integral Enlightenment Telecourse, is to really go there. And yeah, we can talk maybe some more about that a little further along the way here. But I want to say I really love your idea of finding a way to engage the points of difference a bit more, because I did. You know, you're right in the sense that really with this series, I wanted to just kind of bring forward everybody's best thinking on this. I mean, sure, we pushed into a few points of difference along the way, but, you know, all you just have to scratch a little under the surface, and you actually can find vastly diverging points of view on some of these points that we went into between those of us who were in the series. And we didn't so much tear into that. And I think... we'll have to think a little more about how to do it, but I'm really interested in perhaps taking, as the series moves forward into its monthly incarnation, yeah, either doing some special events where maybe we do some panel discussions and get some of these points of difference out on the table, and but between those of us who disagree, and really not so much have dharma debates, but you know, maybe in a more friendly integral embrace, where we're all, you know, debating ourselves in a sense too as we go.
Creative explorations.
Yeah, but I think that would be great, and just to make that an intention moving forward, I think would bring a lot of richness. Because really, if not just this series, but if you think about most of the kind of online audio media content that's out there in the integral space right now, and really in the spiritual arena in general. It's pretty much all of the variety of positive, just conversations bringing out our points of agreement. I can't think of a lot of examples of kind of 21st century Dharma debate going on in the public sphere, you know, in a way that's really modeling a new kind of shared inquiry and so.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think I've seen debates between people who really see themselves as in fundamental disagreement, but
right.
you're probing into something here where there's an awful lot of common ground, but there are differences of emphasis, or, you know, I think this needs to be done first, or I want to go there first, or, you know, I'm fascinated by this aspect of things. Well, I think that's secondary to this other aspect. I think there's a kind of mutual support and agreement that's the context for these debates, and it couldn't really be pursued in a fight to the death kind of a mode. It needs a friendlier context for disagreement.
Because we all still have to play together and be at the same conferences together.
but
there aren't that many of us. So.
And we agree about so much. There is so much in common. It's not the agreements really are louder and more important than the disagreements, but what would it be to push into them?
Right. Nice. Yeah. So that's a great. I appreciate that.
That's exciting. Well, how have others liked it? How has the series been received by the folks for whom it was offered?
Well, my overall impression is that people have been really moved by it. Of course, I suppose you tend to hear most from the people who were the most moved. So it's hard to know for sure how the vast, you know, the whatever, almost 12,000 people who've participated, it's hard to know how the average person feels, right? But I've certainly received a lot of enthusiastic feedback from people. It's funny, this last week I sent out an email to the list, and I made this mistake where I addressed it to Claire, and then I had to send an apology saying, oh, sorry, I screwed up and sent you the wrong email. And somehow that just, I think, invited everybody in a sense to just connect for a moment. And I got hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of emails, just not so much even responding to the mistake I made, other than say, oh, hey, no worries. But then using the, you know, really taking the moment almost of connection to just say, hey, wow, by the way, I just want to tell you, really love the series. And it's, you know, even from some people really saying that it's been a really important part of these last several months for me. It's been a real touch point on my spiritual path. It's been pushing me deeper. It's been opening me to new ideas. So, yeah, just knowing that that's happening for some, you know, real chunk of people is, you know, obviously extremely gratifying and motivating to do more of this. You know, I don't know if everybody knows, but I've just kind of briefly mentioned a couple times lately, but we're actually planning another weekly series like The Great Integral Awakening to kick into gear early next year that's going to be more explicitly focused on what we might call evolutionary spirituality, on how the discovery of evolution is really reconfiguring our understanding of what spirituality is, of what being a human being is, and really penetrating deep into that core insight over, again, an extended series of dialogues like this. So, you know, part of the motivation for doing that has come from just seeing how much it's of a positive it's been for people to be able to have access to this free content. So, yeah. So,
that's
so
great.
So far.
Wow.
I mean, you know, had a few people who apparently didn't like it for whatever reason or thought, you know, this has all been said before, so I'm not interested. Or you always get a few emails that make you question everything about what you're doing with your life. And then you say, no, wait a minute.
Oh, dear. Well, I hope you're not too destabilized by those. I think this has been a rich rich offering. You've given a lot of gifts for this. I've enjoyed them a lot. So for me, the thing that's been most interesting about it is some of the kind of provocative teasers. I know there were many, many places where I due to time, needing to take questions from others, whatever, something was provoked that I was tantalized by, the next conversation, the conversation that didn't have time to happen.
Mm.
And often I had these insights that excited me, and I imagine that must have happened for you too, and I'm curious as to what the insights were that arose that might have been new that these conversations helped provoke or focus?
Well, yeah. I mean, again, there are probably more than I could possibly cover in this time, but there were definitely a lot of, I remember on that first call with Michael Murphy, just not so much even any particular insight, but just feeling this surge of evolutionary energy and kind of passion between us, just because and Mike and I have known each other quite a while. We've talked a lot, but there was a kind of almost giddiness and real like spiraling upward kind of enthusiasm about just this emerging knowledge of evolution and what and how it reframes the human experience, and just the fact that we were both so deeply on the same page about so much was, you know, and I had that a number of times, just that feeling of you know, soul connection with such a kindred spirit of just how many of us there are now that are really starting to feel this new pulse and embody it and work with it and innovate within it, and you know, just that sense. Because sometimes when you start saying, oh, you know, we're creating a new spirituality, you know, you kind of feel, well, doesn't everybody always feel they're doing the new thing? Isn't it always seem that this is the next big new thing? And is there really anything that new and exciting? But this, you know, and of course you get emails telling you that, certainly from people from a more traditional perspective or more postmodern perspective, wanting to kind of flatten out anything that's too enthusiastic or too forward looking or upward looking. But definitely I had a lot of that happen, of just really just pow, you know, just confirmation of my own sensibility about what's happening now and why this is so important and why it's so meaningful that we're starting to really reinvent the spiritual path for our time in an authentic way, not in a superficial way of just trying to mix and match a bit of the West with a bit of the East, or a bit of the new psychology with a bit of the old Dharma, but genuinely trying to push forward into authentic new territory. So I don't know. I don't think I quite answered your question, but that was kind of one of the big pieces for me, this series. In terms of sort of specific insights, I know I had some insights around the big mind conversation. It was funny because there was a moment during that conversation, Genpo kept saying, oh, yeah, you got it right on, when I would respond to him.
Right, I remember.
Very insightful. And at one point he said, well, you obviously really know my work very well. And I had this funny moment where I didn't say it, but I thought, you know, the funny thing is I don't really know Genpo's work at all. I mean, he did Big Mind with me for 5 minutes over dinner once, but I've never attended one of the workshops. I haven't even read the book yet, but there was just this kind of moment of, oh, you know, wow, we're really on the same page in some fundamental ways around this point of innovating new, you know, really new approaches that are particularly approaches that take advantage of our ability to, of our increased self-awareness. Because, you know, the big mind insight in some ways is just, hey, through a conscious choice in yourself, you can simply shift over and give voice to and really access big mind or big heart or really any kind of spiritual faculty or kind of state is not something you necessarily have to work to get to. You can just go there. And he and I had this moment where we were talking about it, and I had this real kind of epiphany that probably wouldn't have worked a couple thousand years ago, because people didn't have enough, that much of a sense of self to say, okay, now I identify with big mind. I can imagine that in that kind of much older, less sophisticated human psyche, it kind of would have been, well, how do I do that? but we now have kind of this facility to move around between different inner states and just consciously shift And he really thought that was a new thing, too, and so we had kind of a powerful moment of kind of recognition, which, again, was, I suppose, a confirmation of a lot of what I was thinking, but it really did give me a kind of opening.
Yes. That's a very interesting and vivid embodiment of how the distinctions between states and stages come into practice as skillful means. That the fact that states are instant and don't have to be earned in the same way lets us get a glimpse of higher states, and that can become an inspiration and a catalyst and even a turbocharger for stabilizing access to those states or actually developing into higher stages. So there's a wonderful kind of just ordinary lived experiential embodiment of what otherwise would be a pretty abstract theoretical principle.
Beautiful. Yeah. And in terms of, I was just going to say one other thing in terms of kind of insights or learnings that I had, because I also had I kind of got more related to and got a deeper understanding of this whole kind of integral approach to the shadow, and this kind of need to sometimes almost be a bit of a Sherlock Holmes trying to like sleuth out the shadow through certain kind of, you know, what we might call indirect approaches, like the 3-2-1 approach. And this came out through my conversation with Diane Hamilton. But, you know, because I've, you know, really the path I've been on and really more my own approach to teaching is a lot of the power and passion behind it comes from the recognition that it's possible to really grapple with the obstacles on the spiritual path, the inner obstacles, that it's possible to actually grapple directly with them, that one doesn't need to necessarily do a lot of psychotherapeutic work to uncover the childhood traumas that have resulted in our particular wounds that then outplay out as our particular pathologies, that it's at least possible, and I've seen it in my own experience and in the experience of many other people, to when there's enough motivation to transform and evolve and enough kind of like deep intention, that it's possible to begin to just make the choice to start to align with something deeper and higher, and in that to confront directly all of the inner obstacles to that deeper alignment in a way that is a kind of radical shortcut that's possible. And part of what is, I think, so much of the passion around, you know, say Andrew Cohen's approach, who was my own teacher, and the evolutionary enlightenment teachings that he has, and also really a lot of the passion in my own approach at Integral Enlightenment is just, hey, there is a kind of change that changes everything that a person can make now that does radically awaken our ability to move, to transcend, surmount, get past a lot of the obstacles that might otherwise seemingly take a whole lifetime to unravel. And so I've come so much from that I've tended to hear things like, well, we need to kind of work with the shadow in these kind of more, you know, subtle, indirect ways. And I think, well, that's, you know, aren't you just capitulating to the ego's desire to let this take your whole lifetime and not really have to kind of step up to the plate? And yet as we went into it more, I kind of realized, well, you know, that direct approach that I'm talking about, it doesn't really work for everybody, actually. It works for some people, and that's partly why it's so exciting, is that it can work. And I think, you know, potentially it could work for everybody, but I could see, you know, very clearly through that conversation that actually a lot of some of these more indirect, kind of gentle, slow, clearly slower, but, you know, nonetheless transformative approach, you know, that they really are actually probably immensely valuable and could, you know, and just, and again, to have in one's transformational toolkit or quiver, you're going to be able to reach a lot more people and help a lot more people if you kind of can play both sides of that, you know, and be willing to know when you need a much less direct approach with someone versus when the direct approach is going to, you know, be the catapult to take them beyond.
Yeah, I really resonate with that. It's an interesting, you know, sometimes I think that very same point that you're describing has been articulated as the difference between a top-down and a bottoms-up approach to transformation.
Right.
And it seems to me that inevitably for many, you know, for most of us, there's some combination. It's a both and, not an either or. And the bottoms up and the top down are both necessary. And even, you know, that so often is a theme in these conversations. I was reflecting as you were speaking earlier about the newness, the actual emergence of an evolutionary and integral spirituality, and how there is something new going on that isn't the same as the path has always been forever. And reflecting that too is a both and, that there is a kind of radical waking up from the dream, freedom from bondage of attention in the gross and subtle dimensions, a kind of simple consciousness awakening that is ancient and in some sense has never changed. And that's a part of it, you know, that the evolutionary spirituality is not a renunciation or a contradiction of the ancient eternal truths. It's a operationalizing of it in an evolutionary context that continues to return to that eternal truth and rests in it and stands in it, you know, as strongly as the most traditional practitioners would, but is also evolving. So this both and theme continues to recur even as you're summarizing what you saw, and I'm appreciating that.
Yeah. No, that's really nice. That's really juicy.
So were there any things that really kind of jumped out and took you completely by surprise? Anything out of left field that you did not expect?
Oh, let me see. Well, I don't think I expected any of my guests to do what Diane Hamilton did, which was ask me to reflect on my perceptions of Michael Jackson as a doorway into what might be my shadow projections on him.
I've been wondering about your feelings about Michael Jackson, Craig. This has been weighing on me.
Because I didn't share. I didn't say what I thought. And, you know, I don't know.
Well, this is your big chance, you know. Fill that gap.
I think we're going to leave it. Maybe I'll write a blog entry about it sometime. Tune into my blog. yeah, anyway, that one took me by surprise. But it was, you know, it was fun. Diane's a playful spirit. And part of what's really great about her is her unpredictability. And so I don't know. I think, you know, in that sense, in terms of surprising moments, probably that. But yeah, like I said, many rich new insights and thoughts for sure emerging all the way along. So,
well, cool.
Yeah.
Well, you know, to ask you a more serious question, I'm curious, you know, asking about the insights is one thing. I'm curious about the major themes. Like when you look back over the whole summer, what were some of the major themes that emerged?
Right. Well, there were obviously probably about 30 total themes, or maybe 50 total themes. But in terms of major ones, one of the things that kept recurring, which I was really happy about, it kept coming up in these dialogues, was this whole notion that there are three faces of God, or as you put it, three faces of spirit. And really, you know, and without going all the way back into it, just the recognition that God can be, or spirit can be, experienced and approached, engaged, either through first person, second person, or third person perspectives, that we can see, can realize God as ourself, as our true self, first person. We can relate to God as a kind of holy other, or, you know, holy thou, second person,
mm-hmm.
you.
The beloved, yeah.
Right. Or as third person, as this kind of it, kind of everything, this kind of like all of reality, or all, you know, all of the manifestation, you know, God in everything, God as everything. Is that doing justice to the third person?
Well, contemplating, yes, contemplating the spirit, yes, exactly, as an object.
Mm. And so that, but particularly this point that I felt, I think the reason it kept coming up and how it related to our larger theme around how the path is evolving and needs to evolve, was that I think there's a dawning recognition in among kind of people who are pioneering and pushing the edge with spirituality that this first person spirituality, this I am that, this realize your true self kind of spirituality that's become so predominant in the kind of contemporary Western postmodern spiritual conversation, that it's really inadequate in some fundamental ways as a transformative spirituality, largely because if you're just realizing, if your whole path consists of realizing your God and realizing your own divinity, there's not necessarily built into that a real kind of gradient, or I don't know what's the way to put it. There's not a way to keep the ego in check is not really built into a purely first-person spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if we look back at the traditions, you know, there was usually some kind of second person, even in a tradition like a lot of Buddhism where there was no theistic, you know, no God, no self, you know,
right.
Still there was this sense of reverence for and bowing to something that was greater than you, you know, to the Dharma, to the Buddha, to the celestial bodhisattvas, whatever it was. And certainly through all the more theistic approaches, this definite sense of God as you, God, that I need to, I'm in relationship with, that I need to be beholden to and serve and be humble before and really try to please almost, you know, try to do right by God, you know, and that in a traditional sense did help diminish ego, I think, in a really powerful way, because it there was clear context in relationship with something bigger than the self. And you know, we don't have that so much anymore in the kind of contemporary West, and we've kind of done away with all that. And I really felt you brought this out, and it came out in my talk with Sally and with Ken, and all along the way, this kept coming out, this sense that, no, actually we need to reclaim that second person relationship with divinity, and even in an evolutionary context, you know, that we need to recognize that God needs us to evolve the world and come into a kind of direct relationship with that aspect of the divine. That, yeah.
Yes, huge. Good. Well, that was an important theme, but I bet you can remember at least a couple of others.
Yeah, right. Well, we could go and go. But yeah, so that was one. And also another one that kept coming up, which was not particularly part of the plan. It wasn't really a topic of any of the specific dialogues, but this whole theme around the need for spiritual authority and the whole student-teacher role and relationship to evolve to something new.
Mm.
The sense that kind of, you know, traditionally, again, there was always the assumption that you needed, you know, in transformative mystical spirituality, that you needed a guru or a master or an elder, you know, someone who was, you know, in a powerful authoritative role in relation to your spiritual path, who could guide you to places that you're never going to find on your own, and because they had gone there themselves. And yet here we are in this, again, contemporary climate, which is very anti-authority, you know, deeply suspicious of any kind of assertions of absoluteness at all, and particularly absolute spiritual authority, which means authority over how to live a human life, just runs so deeply against the grain of post-modernity. And so this came out a lot, just how do we take it forward? Because it was interesting to see that almost everybody, I mean, I think probably everybody in the whole series when this came up said, oh, yeah, you definitely need a teacher. There wasn't really anybody, I mean, maybe once who said, oh, you don't really need a teacher. Just go follow the guru within, which is obviously a kind of popular viewpoint these days that, well, the true guru is within and we just need to follow it.
Well, yeah, and some of the participants, I remember on my dialogue, that was explicitly one of the points that somebody called it and said, I feel like I have the inner guru as my guide. And, you know, and you may remember, I didn't challenge that person.
I tried
to create room for coaching or for another moment in which a teacher might feel congruent.
Right, and you brought up coaching now, and that was one of the things that we've talked about is some of these new kinds of teacher roles where the teacher is, you know, on the one hand, there's coaching, like you offer coaching to people in a spiritual sense and really work with them, and it's a more kind of independent, you're kind of equals in a way. There's not that powerful hierarchy between you, but you can also really speak straight to somebody because you're their coach, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
So that kind of role and just emerging kind of not guru centered, but definitely powerful teacher roles, but where there's just more of a balance of power in the relationship, I guess, where the student is kind of fully empowered to be in charge of their own path, but there's not a diminishment necessarily of the hierarchy of maybe spiritual attainment or realization or insight between those two, you know, and I think that's kind of starting to come into being, I felt, so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that was a big one and an important one for our time, because if we vehemently insist that there's no need for a teacher, you know, a lot of us are not going to get very far because we're going to, you know, I mean, the inner guru certainly at some point on the path can become all that's needed, but a lot of points on the path, we need somebody, you know, and you and I can both attest to that. We both had powerful, you know, guru relationships.
Yeah, yeah, I was just reflecting that two of the people you interviewed, at least, perhaps I'm forgetting someone, but Genpo and Andrew Cohen, really are in that strong, almost, you know, Andrew explicitly calls himself a guru, and Genpo is very much the Roshi, the authority in his Sangha.
Mm-hmm.
So there were even embodiments of that more traditional hierarchical role.
Right, right. And again, I don't think there's any, I don't have a sense that that's somehow outmoded or doesn't work. I found it to be profoundly effective in my own transformation to submit to that kind of powerful guru-disciple relationship. It's just, I think there's a recognition that just given the time we're in, given the way everything's evolving, given our new found agency and autonomy and interiority, that that we need a lot of other things too if we're really going to serve the needs of evolving humanity.
Right. Right. So that's great. So that's interesting that emerged just of its own significance without anything structuring it into the conversations.
Right. I mean, I probably asked people about it, but it wasn't sort of like a major theme, at least in my original construction.
Right.
Another theme was this need for spirituality to come forward into an evolutionary context. This recognition that. As my dialogue with Carter Phipps was titled, "Evolution Changes Everything," which was kind of
so rich, such a real celebration and underlining of that. I thought that was one of the high points of the series.
Me too. Yeah. If you haven't listened to my dialogue with Carter, I highly recommend it. It was really powerful in terms of this particular point about just. You know, it's like we all think we believe in evolution because we were raised with it, you know, but the holdovers from the pre-evolutionary worldview run deep in our psyche, and just what does it really mean to be an evolutionary? What does it really mean to accept, you know, everything that evolution means for being a human being? You know, that we're not, that nothing's fixed, that nothing's staying the same, that everything is changing, can change, and you know, everything about your experience of life could change. Everything about how you show up in life could change. Everything about how humans relate to each other can change. You know, just that the whole, you know, you start to get this utopian sensibility where you realize, wow, you know, actually the whole game could change. Human nature isn't fixed. Just so many levels of that, I think, are incredible and really came out in a number of the conversations.
Yeah, great. So are there any more themes you want?
Yeah, a couple more maybe to mention. I know we're kind of getting close to opening up the conversation here, but there was also just this theme about the need for a more holistic, integral approach to transformation, like you spoke about, you know, with
right.
all the work at Integral Life Practice and Michael Murphy's Integral Transformative Practice and people doing a lot of work to try to balance out the path, in a sense, you know, to not, so that we don't develop in a singular kind of way.
Right.
You can say more about that if you want.
Well,
since that's
yeah,
your
well, that's my work, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, it seems to me that one of the biggest things that looms in our current moment is the odd way that we are all involved in a cultural and personal evolutionary experiment that makes us brothers and sisters on a path, and yet most of us are deeply involved or had, at least at some point in our life, been deeply involved in completely different sanghas. And this divergence into what kind of tends to balkanize the conversation, so that I wouldn't presume to tell a Zen priest that they need to do their practice, you know, even if we're beginning to become friends and brothers on the path, that courage that it takes to intrude and to really point to practice, it tends to be much harder to do that if somebody isn't defining their practice in the same terms you are. A Dharma
right.
brother within a single sangha can kind of see that somebody's not doing their sitting or they're not fulfilling some aspect of the practice and can call them to that, and there's a shared set of references. But as we all discover ourselves in a larger evolutionary path that includes many sanghas, how do we find a common language wherein we are able to relate to one another as sangha mates, as fellow practitioners, such that the engagement with the practice comes alive in our relationships? And Integral Life Practice is one of the ways to open that up. And I think this is going to become a huge theme over the years to come, because we need to discover ourselves in a common path, and these barriers to deeper transformational conversation are going to, I think, fall in a cultural phenomenon that's going to be taking place as evolutionary spirituality is inherited by larger and larger circles of practitioners and people who in the past might not even have thought of themselves as practitioners.
Yeah. Hey, amen to that. That's really exciting, because this is one of the, you know, I spent 13 years of my life in the monastery, so to speak, you know, where everybody I knew saw the world through the same spiritual lens that I did, and it made things really easy. You know, it made navigating relationship really simple, and, you know, yet coming out and, as you know, you and I both have aspirations to build the sort of larger integral evolutionary sangha that's not so much about everybody having the exact same lens, but maybe having the meta frames that allow us to be able to, you know, appreciate the other lenses, but not in a way that's simply just acknowledging difference and just simply valuing difference in and of itself, but able to really penetrate it, understand it, you know, poke around in it, you know, debate about it, but all within a larger kind of integral embrace that sort of facilitates this coming together beyond this or that viewpoint on this or that idea, I guess. Yeah.
Right. Right.
So great.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
All right.
So we're getting close to the end of the first hour, but I have a couple more questions I had wanted to ask. Should I extend?
We can flex a little. We got
okay. Good.
Eight on it.
Well, the thing I didn't get a chance to ask you really is, okay, having asked about all the things I've asked about, what areas were touched on in the series that you feel most incomplete about, that you feel like these areas need more discussion?
Well, and so I don't know if it's as much as incomplete, or maybe, yeah, they didn't come out in some sense. We just went different ways. But I know two areas that I'm really passionate about that I guess I felt I didn't get as much of a chance to dialogue about maybe as I would want to, and that are high on my agenda for future explorations. One of them is this whole notion of what does evolutionary spiritual practice look like? What does an evolutionary spiritual path look like? And in a sense, we talked a lot. There were a lot of conversations about evolutionary spirituality on kind of a larger level in terms of the insights of it, the paradigm shift of it, the how it, you know, how much it changes about how we relate to everything. But then to take that and drill down into it and say, well, how does the spiritual path specifically change when we start to realize that our practice is not just about freeing ourselves or about, you know, just merely waking ourselves up from ignorance and delusion and egoic motivation, but that our path is actually really it's a kind of service to this greater process of evolution that we're all a part of. And where our path starts to become a kind of profound spiritual obligation, in a sense, I just feel there are really a lot of very specific ways and specific shifts that we can engage that give spiritual life so much more juice and so much more power than when we're simply practicing to try to feel better, to try to have more peace, to try to have more contentment, to try to just be more mindful. You know, a lot of the reasons that we practice.
Have higher states.
Yeah, have higher state experiences. You know, all of that stuff's fine. But the truth is, most people, they don't really, there are a lot of people who are doing a lot of practice but don't really feel that it's like working in the ultimate sense. Like people will, you know, a lot of people report, yeah, you know, I've changed a lot. I'm more this, I'm less that. I have more, you know, perspective on my anger, you know. But this kind of sense that I think we have in our spiritual heart, you know, in our seeking heart, the part of us that woke up to the spiritual path and got us on the path in the first place, we have a sense that something really big is possible, you know, that a human life could just be amazing and that our whole consciousness could transform and how we live could transform and our relationships could transform in a way that was just, you know, miraculous, profound, and I truly think that the only way that can really, I mean, I don't want to say the only way. It's bad to always say that. The main way that's going to happen is in this real evolutionary awakening, is really stepping up completely out of the personal self, out of me and my path, trying to improve my situation a bit, and into this. It's kind of the radical new bodhisattva vow. You know, the traditional bodhisattva vow is I will, you know, dedicate my practice and my liberation to the, you know, liberation of all beings. But this isn't just something you say. I'm saying this, that when this is awakened to and embraced and engaged in a practice kind of way, you know, it can just, even if you're not, you know, I'm not saying you're going to be fully enlightened tomorrow, but it can just so profoundly overhaul your experience of being alive and recontextualize who you are, why you're here, what life's about, and in a way that you kind of find yourself just on the path in a powerful way that you know, it just brings everything into alignment, makes everything right in the self, in a sense, and gives context to all the hard work of practice in a way that simply doing it to feel better often doesn't really get you very far, because it doesn't necessarily feel better, at least not for quite a while. And so, so that's one area that, and you know, that's really what I'm doing this telecourse starting in a couple of weeks, a week and a half. That's what that course is all about. You know, it's all about that. What is that change that can change everything? What is the shift to not just having evolutionary aspirations, but to you know, being an awakened evolutionary being who gets out of bed in the morning for completely different reasons than 99.9% of human beings get out of bed, you know, that does everything we do for a completely different set of reasons, driven by a completely different order of motivation, and that really, you know, can be a, you know, a light unto the world, literally, you know, and so that's, you know, that's why I'm doing this course, and that as I feel, you know, a place where we're going to really dive deep into how that can happen.
Cool.
Yeah. Cool. So that's one area. The other area, and then we'll kind of shift in a couple minutes, but the other area is what does evolutionary spiritual community look like? Because, again, we have a lot of old models for community. But what is the new possibility for human beings to come together for a new reason that's really about serving our own evolution, each other's evolution, and this larger evolutionary process that we're all part of, cultural evolution, you know, and just creating a community of evolutionaries, which, again, is part of what I'm trying to do with this course, is really build a community of evolutionaries. But you know, moreover, I just think really to have conversations that rethink the model for human life beyond simply, you know, living your little nuclear life with your family or living alone and having some friends that you hang out with, but how do we really come together in something larger? It's another area that I'm looking forward to going further with, you know, as things move forward.
Great.
Anyway, I'm raving a bit. I could go, you know, I could go the next hour without stopping, I think, right now. So you better arrest me, Terry. And
stop me or I'll talk again.
Yeah.
Well, this is really rich. Maybe we're at the point where we can begin to look ahead to transitioning to the question and answer portion.
Yeah.
Paul?
I think we should. I think let's go ahead and move in that direction. So basically the way we wanted to do this today was not simply to answer questions, which is how we've done it in the past, but to open it to both questions and comments, to contributions that have to do with how this whole series impacted you or new insights you had as a result or things that we should talk about that we haven't yet. You know, I just really want this session for a sense of closure to be really open to a lot of participation. So if you have a question or comment, simply send us that via instant message in the teleseminar window on your computer or dial into the conference line number and wait until we call on you. So before we take your questions, though, I just want to tell you about a couple of opportunities. As I mentioned, on October 17th, I'll be hosting a 9-week telecourse called Integral Enlightenment, Awakening to an Evolutionary Relationship to Life, that is going to really try to unpack in concrete terms what it means to live everything we've been exploring in this whole series, how to sustain and ground an evolutionary and integral relationship to life in the ways I was just speaking about. There's an in-depth online brochure all about that course at integralenlightenment.com/telecourse. That's integralenlightenment.com/telecourse. And as you know, probably our first course date sold out in less than a week. So we decided to offer a second one. We are not going to offer a third one. So this is the last one for 2009. But we just announced this second one a few days ago on Wednesday, and it's already more than half full. So we are expecting it to sell out pretty soon. So if you're interested in engaging in that opportunity, I would encourage you to register pretty soon. So that's integralenlightenment.com/telecourse. Also want to announce that for people living in the Bay Area and who are hearing this today, Alan Combs is going to be launching his new book at Bay Area Integral. Terry, you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Sure.
Since you pulled it together?
Those of you who are familiar with the sophisticated ideas in integral theory may have heard of the Wilbur Combs matrix. Well, Alan is the Combs of Wilbur Combs, and he's the author of a wonderful book, The Radiance of Being, which is one of my favorite integral theoretical books that really helps to make vivid the grand evolutionary synthesis. Now, there's a very famous book by Daniel Dennett that is a completely flatland materialistic reduction of consciousness to the epiphenomenon of biological and chemical and electrical processes called Consciousness Explained. And with his tongue in his cheek, Alan titled his new book, Consciousness Explained Better.
So, that is such a great title, man.
It really is. And Alan himself is quite a character. He's something of a kind of an avuncular cowboy or hell's angel, kind of a gruff every man kind of character, but who's just brilliant and also very much the professor. And he'll be engaging in a kind of freewheeling back and forth about the key controversies in integral theory and thinking and evolutionary ideas. And I think we're going to have a lot of fun. That's going to be on Sunday at 4:30 at the North Bray Community Church. You can find out more about it at bayareaintegral.com, and we hope you'll come.
Yeah, that'll be great. Also, I want to let you know that Terry Patton is an extraordinary coach, spiritual coach, helping to pioneer a whole new way of kind of providing spiritual guidance to people, and he himself has been deeply steeped in the spiritual path for decades and really has a lot of wisdom to share. And Terry, you are taking in some new clients, it sounds like, and you've got an offer to put forward just to people here in the Great Integral Awakening.
Yeah, you won't find anything explicitly describing this offer on my website. My website is integralheart.com. But what you will find is a page describing coaching a little bit and a questionnaire that you can fill out. So if you go to that questionnaire and mention the offer on the Great Integral Awakening, I'll conduct an introductory session with you to just see whether or not this is a fit for you. And what this is an 8 session series that will begin with two particularly a little bit longer sessions in which I'll design a complete integral coaching program for you. But what we'll be doing specifically will be to focus in on your growth to higher consciousness in all senses of that word. And we'll kind of design some orienting frames that are tailor-made, that really focus on the uniqueness of your journey and the next steps that it involves, and then we'll go out from that in 6 additional sessions. So I'll be discounting my normal rate by about 20% for the series, but what I will be offering is an initial conversation to kind of see whether or not this is right for you for just $150, and this will be a longer 75-minute or so conversation. So if you're interested to explore that, please go fill out the coaching questionnaire and mention Integral Enlightenment.
Okay. And that's at integralheart.com. Okay.
Right.
Great, Terry. Well, thanks. Appreciate you offering that to folks. I know a lot of people are looking for help, so hopefully you can connect with some of them. Okay, we're going to now open this up for questions and comments. Again, you know how to do it via instant message in the teleseminar window on your computer. Or if you want to actually chat with us directly, dial into the conference line number. And once you get there, press *2. That's *2. And when you press *2, what that does is it raises your hand in this visual display on my screen. So I see you there with your hand raised, and then I can call on you. And even if it doesn't show your name, it usually says where you're from, and I can sort of call on your location. So, great. So just go ahead and call us up, *2. And let me, we'll first take one from the instant messages here. Okay. This is from Derwin Foster in North Vancouver. He says, my question is, how do we bring integral consciousness down to the level of children, education, and family life? Because at this point, it appears that we're able to address individuals and even couples, but not families yet. This gets at the question of community, or the notion that it takes a whole village to raise a child. Hmm. You have any instant thoughts on that, Terry?
Well,
family man yourself?
My son is 20. I've already made most of my mistakes. But I do have a couple of resources I'd like to refer you to, Derwin. One of them is the remarkable work by my close friend, Frank Marrero. He has a website, frankmarrero.com, frankmarrero.com. And if you, he has quite a bit of different material. He's a fifth grade teacher, but he has what's particularly relevant is his fifth grade curriculum, which is called Big Philosophy for Little Kids. Mm. And it offers a moral and character education for children that I think an insightful parent can adapt for younger children and older. And it's really rigorous. It uses stories because children are, you know, at a mythic mind and need stories to anchor moral lessons. But it helps to focus really in a very, you know, in a kind of a brilliant order. The first lessons are on paying attention, which is kind of the foundational level. You're not going to get very far if your kid isn't even able to pay attention. So it really begins from the ground on up and builds all of it using stories and in a wonderful and very heart-centered way. There's another resource that I'm aware of called Essential Parenting. I think that's essentialparenting.com. A doctor, a pediatrician named Chris White has developed. And so those two resources I think are worth referring you to. Chris has just developed his offering relatively recently, and I'm a little less familiar with the detail of it, but I know that he's I just called it up as I was answering this question, he's actually even offering some in-person classes in the San Francisco Bay Area. Those are the resources I know best.
Well, and also, Derwin, I don't know if you know Miriam Martineau, who is also in Canada, but she is doing work on integral parenting. She's writing a book on it right now and I think offers some workshops or courses on
it. Through their website, Next Step Integral.
That's right, Next Step Integral.
.com.
I think it is .com or .org? Try both. I don't have it off the top of my head. But definitely check her out. And just so you know, a lot of people are talking about this. I know another fellow who is about to do a major career shift who wants to dedicate his life. He's a graduate of the Fielding Integral Theory program, and he is committed, just told me last week, he's committed to dedicating his life to developing a kind of integral parenting model and wants to really push into it. So you are not alone in your question. And so I think I just would really encourage you, because you're such a passionate integralist yourself, to connect with all these folks and maybe start to build the integral family, integral parenting network, because it's really obviously needed, you know, in a big way. So great.
Yes.
Okay. We have a call from London, so I'm going to take that so they don't have to sit online long distance for a long time. So let's take that. You're on the line from London. Looks like a London. See a 4-4 at the beginning. Hi. Who's that?
Hi. It's Edward.
Hi, Edward.
Hi. Great. I have a kind of question and a comment. My comment is I think this is excellent, this whole thing. And I think you've really, today, with the discussion you had at the start, hit on something very important that as we, you know, there's lots of us, you know, finding different aspects ourselves. I mean, I've done a lot of Dzogchen practice, and that gets you what Dzogchen usually gets you in terms of the realization of ultimate truth or ground of being, but it doesn't tell me how to live in the crazy modern world. And I think my comment is that really what the pair of you sort of came to together at the start is exactly right, and that we need to, you know, reinforce our similarities and discuss our differences. I think we really do need to discuss them, because I think it's only together with collective intelligence that we will figure out, you know, the really big questions of, you know, what does integral global economics look like? But I also think, you know, to do it in a very friendly way rather than, you know, sort of, I mean, coming, sorry, I'm a little bit nervous.
Okay.
With the, you know, the sort of coming from the sort of somewhat Tibetan tradition, you know, their debating can be quite sort of adversarial, and I think that doesn't help either. So I think the friendly debate, I think, is the model to take forward. Is the comment sort of part of my observation? But just to really reinforce that, I think the whole thing has been excellent in terms of helping to bring together all these different strands that are somehow together going to form this, you know, whatever 21st century spirituality looks like in all its diversity.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. Beautiful.
Well, you're welcome.
I really appreciate your contribution. I'm with you in all of it.
Great. do you want to move on or?
Oh, well, is there a question you want to ask? Or?
There's a question as well, yeah.
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Yeah, and it relates to what especially you, Craig, and some of the others have talked about, which is the aspiration of, you know, how do we take this on to make the world a better place? And so my question is, it's quite a broad one, how do both of you see the relationship between the cutting edge and the mainstream? Because in a sense, what I see from where I am over the last sort of 10 years that I've been on the path is the cutting edge sort of streaming forward, which it needs to, but also the mainstream just going, you know, well, what are them over there? What are they doing? They've all gone crazy. Do you see what I mean? And I just wondered what both of your perceptions of that relationship was and how you see it evolving.
I'll throw in a couple thoughts on this, and then, Terry, you can jump in as well. One, and thanks, it's a really good question. It's super important. One thought is that I think what you're calling the cutting edge, you know, people who are really pushing the progressive edges of the development of consciousness and the culture that comes from that higher development of consciousness, that I think it has not just... Because from one point of view, you could say, well, what relevance does all of that cutting-edge work have for, you know, how life's playing out for the vast majority of humanity that seems completely, you know, divorced from some of those higher, you know, progressions and conversations. But I think one thing I would say is I do think that the people who are sensitive to that cutting edge need to just keep... One thing we need to do is keep pushing it as far out as we can, you know, to, in a sense, there aren't, when you get, the further out you get toward the edge, the fewer people there are. And so those who have the sensitivity to be leaning out to the edges, be pushing, evolving themselves, evolving the kind of inner subjective structures between us, it's really critical work, and it has to happen, you know, as much of that as possible needs to happen, because in a sense, I think, that when we push that out there, it creates a kind of updraft it creates a pull on everything else. And it's probably not always so visible, but you know, the further that edge goes out, the more kind of a vacuum it's going to create behind it that's going to pull maybe the sort of next layer that's not maybe quite the leading edge, but the sort of broadly progressive layer is going to be then pulled. They're the ones that are going to be able to recognize, wow, look at those people out there on the edge. I need to go in that direction. And so they're going to get pulled forward. And as they get pulled forward, they're going to create a draft behind them to the people who are maybe more just resting comfortably in the middle, as you might say, and kind of go, wow, those people who aren't that much different from me, but they're a bit more, you know, out there, I can see where they're going, and it seems right, and they can start to follow that, and so on. You know, I think it goes all the way to the least progressive, most entrenched parts are going to be pulled by the people who are a little further along than them moving forward. So in a sense, we all need to keep pushing where we're at. And so I think it's an error to sort of turn and say, well, you know, what does all this out here have to do with anything? I need to go back and try to help those people in the mainstream get unstuck. However, I think a big part of what the work those of us out, you know, pushing the edge do need to do is to be very aware of this whole spiral of development that we're a part of and really be thinking about the whole, you know, not to the exclusion of pushing our own edges and pushing the edges, but really be doing that in the context of where is the whole at, what are the key developmental level steps that need to be happening all the way up the spiral of development, and how can we be instrumental in helping facilitate those. So we can't just we shouldn't all just go out to the edge. Some people, that's all they're going to do is go push the edge, and I say, beautiful, go do it, because somebody needs to. But also, I think there need to be a lot of people who are both on the edge and really reaching back to kind of scoop in, you know, the broader sweeps.
That's exactly right. There are a number of ways in which this is going to automatically happen. One of the things is that many of us who are working spiritually are earning our living through doing it, and there are many more people closer to the mainstream. So inevitably, the market draws people toward that lowest common denominator, and I think that that's an expression of the social need that you were observing, Edward, in your question. So inevitably, people who are working at the edge are each going to have a unique way of expressing their service. You know, some people are trying to offer new, more enlightened approaches to parenting, and they will hopefully reach many people who are otherwise relatively conventional in the way that they're approaching parenting, and they'll help those folks grow just, you know, in some sense, pressing the edge, maybe even gently. Maybe it's just a half step, you know, maybe a nudge in the direction of evolution. But each of us offering our unique gifts in whatever way is appropriate is the chaotic expression of a larger movement in evolution and consciousness that hopefully will reach all the way down to people who are falling through the social safety nets, who are in homeless shelters or rehab programs, whose lives have really foundered on the rocks. And it's everybody, every soul matters equally, and there's a kind of open-heartedness that arrives in a discriminating and clear-eyed way at an integral level of development that lets us really move very freely throughout the whole spectrum and offer whatever we can all the way across. So I don't think that people on the edge are only involved in the conversations at the leading edge. I think we're involved in all the different ways we might help other people.
Beautiful.
Great. Thank you so much.
Hey, Edward, thanks. Really enjoyed the conversation. Thanks for bringing it forward.
Yeah, that was a great question.
Okay, great. Thank you. Right. Bye-bye.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Yeah, bye-bye.
All right. So let's go to another one through the instant message here. Kind of like to rotate back and forth. Let's see here. Okay. How about, this is from Moni in Houston. She says, congratulations for the successful completion of this 15-part series. I only missed two of them in the live participation. I thoroughly enjoyed and learned a lot, and it helped me make progress in my spiritual life. I still have this question I thought was not fully addressed. Quote, dealing with the challenges in practicing spirituality amidst fulfilling commitments, obligations to family, friends, and community. There's always this fear of not being able to perform these commitments if the spirituality is practiced seriously. I appreciate if you can address this in this latest webcast. Thank you very much. Thanks, Moni. Do you have one on that, Terry? You want to start off, or?
Well, I think it's really one of the places that the rubber meets the road. It's a very important and central question that everyone has to answer in their lives. And yeah, I'd love to hear what you have to say, Craig, and maybe I'll add in a little something, but I don't think this is a secondary, it's almost a first step question that everybody's got to find a way to deal with, and it's not always easy.
Well, you know, what's interesting about this is this actually came up quite a bit during the series of people, I think, in response to some of the more out there conversations or, you know, edge pushing dialogue about giving everything to one's spiritual life. I know it's one I get a lot because I'm always talking about really, you know, what does it mean to take it completely seriously, to give everything to your spiritual path, to make that your top priority, which I obviously am following in the footsteps of my own teacher because that's so central to his whole stance. But the interesting thing, there's always this, as she put, as Mani puts it, there's always this fear of not being able to perform these commitments if I take my spirituality seriously. And, you know, and I think it's an interesting, I mean, in a sense, it's too bad we're not on the phone because we could dissect it a little more clearly and maybe understand what the specific fear is. But there's, and we talked about this in one of the other dialogues as well, but there's always this sense that somehow there's kind of this fear that, well, if I give everything to spiritual life, what about my kids? I hear that this one a lot. You know, what about my family? Am I gonna does that mean I'm gonna forget about my family, or I'm gonna not care about to take care of my kids anymore, or I'm gonna, you know, throw everybody out and just go and become a monk in a, you know, go live in a cave alone or something? And I think that interesting in that there's a kind of doubt in that, in a sense of doubting the inherent goodness of the very thing we want to give ourselves to. Because, you see, if we say, well, what are we really talking about when we say give everything to our spiritual path? It means I make the most important thing, spirituality, I make that the most important thing to me. I make it the most important thing in my life. I decide that, well, there are many things that are important, but there's one thing that's the matter of utmost concern, and I'm going to put it number one. And that means I'm going to organize my life around it. I'm going to make it the most my practice, but not just on the cushion. I'm going to bring my life into alignment with my own deepest knowing, my deepest intuitions about life, with my highest values, with my ultimate priorities. I'm going to bring this all together in one thing. And so, but when we say that, what we're saying is I'm going to align with God, meaning, you know, with the impulse toward the good, the true, and the beautiful, the impulse toward perfection, toward, you know, that which when we experience it, we know as perfect love, you know, as nothing but ultimate love and wisdom. And so then, in a sense, couldn't we assume that if we gave everything to that, that all of the important things in our life that need to be taken care of, that we would still take care of them? Because now we would be, in a sense, aligned with God. So we'd be that force of love on earth. So wouldn't we then assume that we would still take care of our kids, still look after our important relationships, still deal with our responsibilities? Whereas there's kind of the sense, well, if I gave myself to that, somehow, you know, I would not care anymore about people, or I wouldn't care about being responsible. I'd be irresponsible. I'd let things fall through the cracks. So I think there's a way when we have these fears, we're not really, that it's just a matter of they haven't been reflected upon deeply enough to really understand what we're actually, what we're fearing doesn't, at least in my point of view, and again, I'm speaking from how I see these things, but I don't think it makes sense to fear that. And certainly in my own experience, the more profoundly I've given myself over to that deeper calling, the more I've been willing to take big risks for it, the more my life has worked out. And I'm not saying that by doing that, somehow some outside force comes in and makes my life work out. I mean, there may be mysterious elements like that in play, but that's certainly not part of my pedagogy. But what I would say is more, you know, we become more sane. We become more clear. Our motives become clarified. Our priorities become properly aligned. And we become somebody who's able to make really good decisions about all the practical things in life. So things start to line up and make more sense. We become more responsible for all the things we should be responsible for. We become better parents to our children because we're actually modeling, you know, what it is to be a sane, wise, healthy, loving person as opposed to, you know, someone who's lost in a lot of neurotic old patterns from the past. So, you know, in so many ways, I think that it's an unfounded fear, and it's really one of the, we might say it's one of the ego's tricks to keep us from making that leap toward the divine, which would start to annihilate the ego in the negative sense. It would start to undermine the ego's agenda. So the ego throws this up and says, hey, wait a minute, danger, don't go there, you know, what about all these things? But I think when we really reflect on it in a deeper way, we can come to see that all the risks we take for God are going to be, you know, good ones, I think. I mean, within a reason. So.
Well, I think there's another nuance nice to add to that conversation, which is that for most people, there is a life in place as the spiritual impulse awakens. And there are commitments and relationships that have been engaged in a way that might have had a lot of love in them, but were not explicitly expressions of a spiritual commitment in their original formation. You know, we've got patterns, we've got expectations in relationships, all of which are based on the way we have been up until now. And this transformative shift, you know, especially for people whose spouses are less lit up by the awakening spiritual urge than they are, these things seem like dilemmas. And I think it's important to respect that there are actual functional tensions that everybody's having to encounter. And yet I think your answer is essentially correct, that as we really come into a commitment that is transcending ourselves, it's not dismissing of the need of our children or our spouse for our love. In fact, it's a way of turning us out from the egoic demand for love and the mood, you don't love me, I need this or that from you, into the mood of I love you. That's the essential turning into connection, into relationship, and it can show up in all our relationships. And then there are shifts and transformations and tensions that do arise, and the experience of those tensions can apparently be a dilemma, but it is in the heart turning outward in a self-giving and self-transcending gesture that really gives us the resolution. It's always by loving more, giving more, turning out of our self-enclosure and our self-contraction that we find our way through these apparent dilemmas.
Very nice. Great addition you brought in there, too. Thank you, Terry. And thanks, Monty, for your question. We're going to take one via instant message now from Honolulu from Austin, Morioka. You're on the line.
Hi. First of all, I definitely thank you guys. You guys are just great. You've done an awesome job. It's been completely insightful and inspiring what you've done through this teleseminars. And I'm really looking forward to your telecourse.
Thank you.
And I guess my question is for both of you gentlemen. One, Terry, on one of your videos, you had mentioned the third tier, or basically doing the will of God. And that's something for people I speak to about Integral Theory or even Ken Wilber, that it's so material that it doesn't involve true service or true surrender. And also, Craig, on how the evolutionary impulse being, it seems as though being of true service and, again, surrendering to what is good, what is true, and what is beautiful, and how both of those are essentially the same thing. And just helping my dialogue with my friends, or even just understanding both sides and how they play together.
Terry, did you get that first part?
I didn't completely get
it. Yeah, I didn't quite either. Could you restate that, and then Terry maybe can answer that, and then I'll take the other part?
Yeah. So, Terry, on one of your videos on your website, there was, right at the very last second, you had mentioned something about a third tier.
Yes.
I've never heard that before through any of the other work out there. So I was just wondering more if you could share that a little bit on what that was.
Oh, okay.
And how the third tier, I think you said it was the will of God, doing the will of God. I might be wrong exactly by word. And then how that relates to the evolutionary impulse. And I think, Craig, you might have even answered that on your last question. With the instant message you answered just recently.
Well, in many conversations with Ken, he's articulated that he sees a third tier beyond second tier at the point where a truly transpersonal relationship to life clicks in. And in his color coding of altitudes, for those of you who are really into the theory, this kicks in at about indigo. And that this is very high levels of development. It's more or less the kind of thing that appears among highly developed people, you know, who are often spiritual realizers, or in a sense, third tier. It has to do with levels of spiritual realization as they shape our comprehension of experience. You know, these tiers, these stages have to do with our meaning making, our way of making sense of experience. And then there's another kind of growth that Ken refers to as the state stage growth, which is the traditional spiritual mystical path of awakening, which is a little distinct from it. But at the highest levels of our meaning making, in a sense, they come back together. And for me, the key thing in this high level of growth is that one really graduates from a self-orientation altogether. So instead of making choices about how we want to live our lives or what is important to us, we really find ourselves seized by an imperative outside ourselves. And in a sense, we're liberated from doing what we want into doing what we must. That the imperatives of the larger will and intelligence and transpersonal evolutionary flow begin to arrive as our own sense of what's necessary, and in a sense, this is a great relief. There's a kind of a false luxury in having all this choice about what we want to do. Mm-hmm. When you're liberated to simply do what is necessary, what we must, and you're kind of, you know, let thy will be done. You're in a flow of what is greater than yourself, and simply in service of that, without the burden of having to step in and think about what you want. There's a kind of happiness and freedom that is of a different order, and that, to me, is my best feeling sense of the key hinge that represents this transition that Ken calls this third tier consciousness.
Beautiful, Terry. Yeah. Amen. I could not be more on the same page with you about that.
Mm. And so, Craig, just to make sure, I guess this is where I was leading on your end,
yeah,
that the evolutionary impulse, like you said, being in alignment with that, which is to become and give more, would be somewhat the best tool to get to that third tier, the daily living of doing and being of service for something greater than ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely right. And I would add a little to that, because the interesting thing is, I would say, I mean, if you look at the subtitle for the talk I gave as part of the Great Integral Awakening, it was how to align your was awakening to the call of the cosmos, how to align your life with the impulse of evolution, you know, and very much, obviously, this is a big part of what I'm so passionate about and really trying to convey and share and teach is what it really means to bring about this different kind of alignment, this different orientation, which Terry was just talking about. Now, the interesting thing is, when you bring that into practice, as somebody who maybe isn't, you know, brimming over with this surging kind of conscious experience of that evolutionary impulse, as Andrew Cohen calls it, or, you know, this will of God, because it can start to become something that is just your conscious experience. It's your conscience, in a sense, starts to become more aligned with this kind of divine will, or this order of things, this deeper order, this deeper imperative. But in the absence of having that, having yet reached that third tier, I guess, where that starts to become a conscious experience, the question is, how do you do it? And so part of it is, as you said, well, you know, do everything you can to do the best you can to be aligned with serving what you can see as the greater will, because you might not really know. You might be taking a shot. Like, you know, in a sense, a really good question is just, well, what would it mean to do the right thing? And making as much effort as we can to always do the right thing to the degree that we can perceive it. Because when most of us look at our lives, what we find is, well, actually, there are, you know, most of us are thinking, well, I need more spiritual experience. I need more insight. I want to get to that third tier where I'm really aware of the will of God. But then when we step back and look at our own lives, we can see, well, actually, there are a whole bunch of things that right now I know I should be doing that I'm not doing. There are a whole bunch of things I'm currently doing that I know I shouldn't be doing. So then I say, well, stop doing all the things that you're doing that you know really you shouldn't be. Start doing all the things that you know you should be doing that you're not, and then move forward into tomorrow from there. And then what's going to happen is it's going to get refined if you're inquiring, if you're paying attention, and you're still asking, how do I do the right thing for the highest reasons? Then you're going to see another layer, and you're going to then have to act on that and push deeper into that and say, okay, now I have to take responsibility for everything else I've seen. But the other big part of this is it actually, in the end, tends to have more to do with seeing all the things we're doing that are not in alignment with the greater will, with that evolutionary impulse, and stopping and renouncing those actions that are not in alignment with what we can sense to be that higher trajectory. And in a sense, we tend to have to just say no to a lot of things in ourselves that are very habitual before we start to get this clear, positive option emerging on the other side, which is often why the path is experienced as a kind of walking through a ring of fire or a kind of jumping off a cliff or traversing a razor's edge, because there's a point at which you have to really just, you have to see, oh, there's so much about my relationship to life that's not really spiritual. It's not really holy. It's not really aligned with my deeper self, with the divine will, whatever we want to conceive that as. It's not really aligned, and I have to just start to reject all that and no longer be playing out those patterns. But I don't get immediately the satisfaction of going, oh, and instead of that, now I get to do all of these, you know, positive actions, because it doesn't tend to show up that way. We kind of have to go through a period where it's really saying no to a lot, letting go of a lot, without it being replaced by this surging evolutionary impulse in our being that's carrying us forward to our evolutionary destiny. That does start to happen at a certain point, or it does start to surge and start to take us over. We actually can start to feel like we're being taken over by a force that's greater than ourselves. And at that point, if the only way we're going to be ready to really surrender to that when it comes is if we've been fundamentally bringing our life into align with the deepest truths we know through our active choices every day to do the best we can to not align with that old momentum and align with this higher momentum. So it's it's a big leap, but I completely agree with you, Austin, with your basic tenet that doing that work is the most certain and the most direct path to that awakening of that third tier possibility. So
thank you so much, guys. Thank you. That's perfect.
Thank you.
Thank you, Austin.
All right. Okay, we're going to go back to the instant messages here. See what else we have. Oh, here's one that came through. This is fun, Terry, and you're going to get a lot of good points on this one. I have to find it again. I just saw it a second ago. Was asking from Berkeley. Where is it? Peter in Berkeley. Hey, guys, curious about what kinds of cars you drive. What are the material choices you have made? So Terry wins because he drives a Prius. And what better car can you drive than that? Now,
the older the Prius, the better.
Oh, yeah. Okay, good. Well, I almost got a Prius last year when it was time to get a different car. But the truth is I spend a lot of time in the mountains in the winter, and I needed something four-wheel drive, and I couldn't find anything like a Prius that would really be a good snow car. So I got an Audi, which has all-wheel drive. It was the most, best gas mileage of all the Audis I could get, but all the four-wheel drive type vehicles I could get. But I'm still waiting for that fantastic hybrid Audi all-wheel drive to come forward that can stomp the Prius in terms of mileage.
You know, this is a kind of, I think, you know, it's a little bit of a poke in the ribs to us, which is just fine. I think it's in,
it's important.
Yeah, it is. And yet it begs a larger question. There are an awful lot of folks in the integral world who range across the spectrum of attitudes toward these personal choices. Some people are very, very virtuous, recycling, buying in bulk, composting, doing all the personal gestures. Others, less so. And there's an argument in the integral world that the real changes that are going to make the difference have to do with, there's a number of different arguments. One of them has to do with culture change and the interior quadrants being so essential. As long as we have people driving Hummers and governmental policies that subsidize oil as a fuel source, how are we involved in trying to cultivate a kind of immunity from the sense of the unsustainability of our lifestyles, and kind of cultivating a sense of virtue that insulates us from the importance to be change agents in ways that actually transform larger systems? And shouldn't we be focusing there more than just trying to be blameless, which is perhaps illusory anyway?
Mm.
Does that make sense?
Totally. The interesting thing is, I mean, where I come down, I definitely come down fairly strongly on that side, but in a really both-and kind of way, because I think that all of us should strive to make the best environmental footprint choices we can make. I mean, I dedicated, a good chunk, year and a half of my life or so, not that long ago, to really trying to propagate a carbon footprint reduction program called the Low Carbon Diet, which really cuts much deeper than just what car you drive, but all the kinds of lifestyle choices you make and how to really do that. So I've done a lot of work on that. Interestingly, you are also an environmentalist, and you do the work on restorative forestry. So we're both guys who have a hand, are interested in that trench work of, actually working on these external systems and behavior change and choices and things like that. And I'm, in my own life, try to be as rigorous as I can about those choices. But definitely, when push comes to shove, I'm going to side with, the best use of my time is not making sure that every little thing that could possibly, every little plastic spoon that could possibly get recycled gets recycled at the expense of, dealing with these larger, the shifting of the larger inner structures, which is the evolution of consciousness and culture that you and I are both, together in this great work trying to do. That's still, in the end, where I would tend to come down. But I think it's too easy to then just say, well, I'm doing that, so I don't need to really worry about my personal footprint, and I can drive my Hummer and have my enormous house and,
I like that. I think the both and response feels truest to me as well. And yet it's important to surface that there's an interesting controversy among integralists. Most mm-hmm. of us, both of us, Craig, we fly a lot, and that's terrible.
Right.
I invest tons of money in forest lands and do, 10 times or 100 times my share of carbon offsets in a sense through that, but it doesn't mean that there's no cost in this choice I'm making to go around the country and around the world and teach.
And
I think there's something about letting ourselves continue to be worked on by the koans that these questions represent. And I know you do. Your excitement about trying to create some sort of cooperative community living circumstance as your way of living has in part a sustainability motivation, because clearly this everybody in their own castle suburbia way of living that most of us find ourselves in is not just culturally less satisfying, but in surely material terms, it's costly and less sustainable.
Right on. Yeah, so good. I like what you're saying about living in the koan of it, because there's no easy answer here, right? Being alive at this time, being deployed here in the Western world where we consume so much, where even at our best, we consume such a high percentage of the world's resources relative, we have such a big impact, each one of us, just because of the inherent systems in our culture. None of us get to kind of just rest and say, oh, well, can't change it, can't avoid it, just doing it. I think we have to live with that and let it push us further and deeper.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, obviously we could go on. We have a lot more people who want to ask questions. I would encourage, if you didn't get a chance to make your comment in this space or ask your question, I'd encourage you to go to our Facebook group and post it there. And there are a lot of people who will jump into the conversation with you. That's just go to Great Integral Awakening. Go to Facebook and search for Great Integral Awakening Group, or you can just click on the Facebook link in the email that we sent you this morning, and you will find that. So, all right. Well, Terry, any last thoughts before we wrap?
I just want to thank you, Craig. This has been a lot of fun. I really appreciate the opportunity to extend our dialogues in a way that interacts with a whole broader group. I was really impressed with the quality of the questions today and feel the sense of this conversation taking place in a larger space that includes a lot of folks, many people I meet, but many I haven't met, and that sense of larger sangha is just a real inspiring and it's a wonderful good feeling to sense that larger connection. And I just want to appreciate everyone who's on the line to appreciate you. So thank you.
Well, I appreciate you too, and thanks for coming on as my co-host and interviewer and all that today. This was fun, a nice experiment and turning of the mic, so to speak. So, yeah, and I just want to say I've really appreciated everybody's passionate and enthusiastic participation over this whole summer and today, and I look forward to it continuing. I hope you'll all stay with us. The series is going to go monthly. I'll be sending out an email with all the information on upcoming events. We're going to shift times, et cetera, but I'll be letting you know. So stay tuned to the emails, and you'll get all the information on what's next. And like I said, coming in January, we'll be doing a whole nother weekly series with a slightly different emphasis. So please do stay tuned for all of that. And again, if you want to learn more about the work of Terry Patton, visit integralheart.com. That's integralheart.com. If you want to learn more about my work, visit integralenlightenment.com. And if you'd like to make a financial contribution to help support us in offering these free dialogues, just click on the link in the email we sent you this morning. That will certainly go a long way toward helping us perpetuate all of these free series and being able to make this available to so many people. If you have any friends that you think might be interested in this series, please forward them one of our emails so they can join us. And if someone sent you this audio or you found it somewhere on the web and you'd like to listen to the other dialogues in this series, just visit greatintegralawakening.com. That's greatintegralawakening.com. Finally, I want to thank all the sponsors who've helped make this possible, including Now and Zen, makers of the Zen Alarm Clock, iEvolve Global Practice Community, The Shift Movie, The New Feminine Power, Ursa Minor Arts and Media, who helped so much with the websites for both the Great Integral Awakening and integralenlightenment.com. I also want to thank Enlighten Next, Next Step Integral, and Big Mind, and our co-host in bringing all this to you, Integral Life. So stay tuned, and we will we'll be in touch. Thanks so much for joining us, and keep evolving. We'll go ahead and unmute the line so everyone can say a quick goodbye. Bye, everyone.
Goodbye.
Bye.
So long.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Be well, guys.
Thank you.